Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
January 24th, 1848. Carpenter James W. Marshall is working at Sutter's Mill in California's Sierra Nevada foothills. He notices something in the water. Flakes of a shiny metal. He writes several years later, quote, "I then collected 4 or 5 pieces and went up to Mr. Scott, who was working at the carpenter's bench making the mill wheel, with the pieces in my hand, and I said, 'I have found it.' 'What is it?' inquired Scott. I answered, 'Gold.'" Well, the news quickly spread, and soon the California gold rush of 1849 was on.
You just can't imagine what it was like when we got the news back home that gold was discovered in California. Folks near went crazy. They just picked up their belongings and headed west, thousands of them, young and old, by boat, wagon train, riding, walking, any way they could get to where the gold was.
That was from the 1956 movie The Naked Hills. In real life, by 1850, more than 100,000 people had migrated into California from all over the world, and that put California on the fast track to statehood, achieved on September 9th, 1850. So for most Californians, except, of course, indigenous peoples who'd been there for thousands of years, the story of California is the story of wave after wave of migration. Take, for example, the 1930s, as captured in this CBS documentary.
Between the years 1935 and 1939, 350,000 people left their homes and farms in the Dust Bowl. Leaving the land behind, they made for Highway 66, their path of exodus, across mountains and desert to the green promised land, California.
Again, in 1965, after President Lyndon Johnson signed the Immigration and Nationality Act.
This bill says simply that from this day forth, those wishing to immigrate to America shall be admitted on the basis of their skills and their close relationships to those already here.
Well, millions more arrived in California. In fact, it wasn't until 2010 that the number of native-born Californians finally surpassed the number of Californians who were born out of state. But after all those waves of in-migration, the tide may be turning in California, because now the state is experiencing paltry population growth. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today on Point, it's being called the California Exodus. Is it real? And if so, what's driving it? And what, as always, should the rest of the country learn from the nation's most populous state, one with a $3.1 trillion gross state product? And I just always love this fact. If California were a country, that would make it the fifth largest economy in the world. So it's always a good time to look at California. And we're going to start today with Lauren Hepler, economy reporter for Cal Matters. She joins us from Santa Cruz. Lauren, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So is there a mass exodus from California?
It is the question of the hour, for sure. And it's funny because I just asked the governor's new economic advisor about this. It's the former Clinton press secretary, Dee Dee Myers. And her answer was, first of all, yes, this talk is completely overblown. It seems to have gone into overdrive after people like Tesla CEO Elon Musk have very publicly talked about how they're heading out for Texas during the pandemic. But she also said, yes, on the other hand, this conversation really does sort of crystallize a lot of major long-term challenges in the state with things like housing, transportation, and taxes that, again, it in a lot of ways, it does make sense to think about right now because people have this time away from their grueling 4-hour-long commutes and all of these other sort of daily circumstances that had kept things the way they were for so long.
Okay, so yes and yes. Take that, easy narratives. Okay. I'm always willing to take down convenient narratives here. So let's dive into the complexity. Okay, because I am seeing, first of all, just the sheer sort of raw numbers in terms of migration, that there was some numbers that came out that measured migration from July 1 of 2019 to July 1 of 2020. So, of course, that captures in the pandemic, too. But across those 12 months, California's population grew only by roughly 21,000 people, okay? And that's with a state that already had almost 40 million. So a 0.05% growth in population, that does seem minuscule.
Right. That's very small. And it's a big drop from other recent years, especially after the Great Recession. There was a major influx of people from other states, not to mention these massive migrations that we've seen in previous decades. The other statistic that's really caught in a lot of people's attention was that last year, that same time frame from July 2019 to July 2020, 135,000 more people left the state than moved here. And that's only the 12th time that that's happened since 1900. What's happening when you dig below, okay, how is the population still growing if more people are moving to other states? The bulk of the people moving to California are coming from other countries. And then when you drill down into who's moving from state to state and coming into California, it's definitely higher earners, more affluent people. So again, you've got multiple things going on at once, but the high level takeaway is that you've got a lot more people moving to other states than coming here from other U.S. states.
And they're the high earners, you said. Okay, so in terms of why they're moving, we're gonna get to that in depth in a second here. But the other fact that you said that most of the people moving into the state are from other countries, not even within the United States. I mean, again, we're looking at that July 2019 to July 2020 timeframe. The pandemic must have definitely slowed that in-migration from international sources.
Yeah, I mean, you would definitely think so. But one of the things that's tricky about all of this is that there's a lag with this kind of demographic data. Those numbers on 2019 and only through July 2020 kind of just came out. So we don't even know what happened after July 2020 yet. And that's why, on one hand, you'll hear a lot of state policymakers say it's hard to make decisions based on this idea of an exodus right now when we don't even know how real it is, sort of when it comes to the numbers. So that's been kind of an ongoing challenge in terms of waiting for that census data to come out, or the IRS also tracks, obviously, taxpayers moving from state to state. So that also sort of kicks the can down the road on all of this.
Okay. But so the headline grabbing nature of this is both of, you know, for economic reasons and political reasons. But I do want to just talk with you for a second, Lauren, about some of those headlines, right? I mean, particularly you mentioned Elon Musk. So the tech sector has been kind of restive in terms of its love affair with California. So Tesla moving its headquarters. But I think more interestingly, Oracle and Hewlett-Packard. I mean, Hewlett-Packard is a company that basically defined the birth of Silicon Valley, right? I mean, what is it? Bill and Dave's Garage is a national historic landmark there. And to see Hewlett-Packard say, we're going to up and move somewhere else, certainly that must have been eye-opening.
Right. That was a big one. And it definitely kind of dredges up things that have been familiar refrains when thinking about California compared to other states for business reasons. So for a long time, like I remember during the Great Recession about a decade ago, you had a very similar conversation with business executives from Arizona or Texas flying in and doing these roadshows, especially in Silicon Valley, saying, hey, move all of your office workers to our state. We've got low taxes. They can buy nice big houses. It'll be great. And then it seems like we're kind of at that moment again. But the question is, will it be even more convincing this time around, given this kind of unprecedented shift to remote work we've seen that arguably makes location even less important? And if the idea is that people have been paying a premium to be in California for those sort of physical locational reasons, will that continue after all of this?
Okay, so if the truth is more complicated, not even if, the truth is more complicated, right? I'm still thinking about that double yes and yes is still echoing in my head. At the same time, though, there obviously our attention was really caught by California exodus. Where is that narrative coming from?
Okay, so that's a really interesting question, because on the one hand, you'll see it sort of at a very grassroots level, like folks who are posting on Facebook about, you know, I'm sick of this. One woman I interviewed, she was in Modesto, which is a more agricultural part of California. And she said, my family has been living in a one-bedroom apartment. My husband and I sleep in the one bedroom with our infant. and our school age son is living in the living room. And that's just completely unsustainable. The pandemic, being at home so much, was the breaking point. They said, we're out of here. We're moving to Utah. So you definitely hear that kind of thing from working class folks who have just said this is too much. And that's a very real sentiment. You also hear the same thing, like I alluded to, with businesses thinking about taxes and lower costs out of state. I also talked to a fair number of folks who are kind of retirement age, and their homes in California have massively appreciated over time. So they're able to, you know, cash out, get a couple million dollars, and then ride off into the sunset to Scottsdale or whatever other retirement destination and sort of live there, lower tax. But on the other hand, there's also definitely folks who are very interested in fueling this narrative, specifically that phrase, California Exodus, you will see everywhere on YouTube, associated with mostly right-leaning groups. So there's one called PragerU that's very specifically funded by folks who were Trump mega donors. And you'll see in all of this sort of horrific footage of California talking about how it's a third world country, all of this, then you'll get sort of the shot, the split screen over to Texas, where it's like golden retrievers and kids bounding down a school bus and Ted Cruz talking about how great everything is. So there's certainly like very explicitly political things going on here as well. But it's very smartly tapping into real resentment and frustration on the ground.
Okay, so on the one hand, the split screen is quite an engaging visual, Lauren. Like the hellish wildfires and high taxes of California, and then golden retrievers and kids bounding onto school buses in Texas. I mean, look, folks listening in California and Texas, hop onto social media. We're at On Point Radio on Twitter and Facebook, and let us know if that split screen sounds familiar to you, or is there, this is a deviate from reality a little bit. So we're talking about the narrative. We're interrogating the narrative of a mass exodus from California and what parts of it are true, what parts of it aren't true, and what lessons it holds for the rest of the country. So Lauren Hepler joins us. She's economy reporter for Cal Matters. We're going to dig into more about exactly who is leaving the state when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are exploring this narrative that we've been hearing recently about California and how there's a mass exodus of people leaving the state for a whole variety of reasons. One fact is true. They have had historic low population growth over the past year. It's only the kind of minuscule growth that California has seen just a handful of times over the past century. So we want to understand what is driving that, what lessons the rest of the country has to learn from California. I'm joined today by Lauren Hepler. She's economy reporter for Cal Matters, and she's with us from Santa Cruz, California. And joining us now from Los Angeles is Adam Fowler, director of research at Beacon Economics and the University of California Riverside Center for Economic Forecasting and Development. Welcome to On Point, Adam.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so I am in kind of a narrative-busting, complexity-embracing mood here. So tell us, what are the numbers that you think we ought to be paying attention to when it comes to understanding population dynamics in California right now?
Absolutely. I think one of the most interesting things is the component parts of population, births, deaths, migration. Migration's important because it signals oftentimes where we have policy failures. And in California, we've had decades of really problematic public policy that has often been papered over by strong population growth, strong economic activity, industries being developed, nurtured, brought to life here in California. And so oftentimes when things are going well, they're going well in spite of some problematic public policy making. And so when things begin to slow down, we begin to re-examine some of those things. In California, our housing regulatory system has been very problematic. And I think what's interesting is that these are challenges that a lot of our urban areas are seeing. This isn't just a California problem.
Well, so let me ask you, in terms of housing, transportation, and the money which ostensibly goes to support those very important parts of life, critical parts of life, we will get to that because the policies are what matter. But I wanted to check something with you, or at least get a little bit more detail, because Lauren had said earlier that the people who are leaving, and Lauren, I don't mean to misquote you here, but is it largely sort of upper income Californians? I mean, who is leaving, Adam? Have you had a chance to look into that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So in a normal economy and during normal kind of times without a pandemic, the flow of people is important. Geography, economic geography, the ability of people to seize opportunity, move around the country is very important. We look at net numbers, so inflows of various character traits, demographic traits of households, and outflows and kind of net out. On net, who are we seeing in and out, and what is that doing for our population? What we've seen recently, really coming out of the Great Recession, 2008, 2009, is that lower income households have been fleeing the state on net, and higher income households have been coming in. So we've been importing wealthier, more educated households, and we've been exporting lower income households and the kind of the associated educational components, the associated occupational components of those households. The last couple of years, we've actually seen everyone kind of stagnate. So what's been interesting in the American Community Survey from the Census Bureau has shown in the last 2 years, we have robust data that we've actually put the brakes on importing wealthier folks compared to the last decade.
Okay, interesting. Lauren, did you want to add to that?
No, I think that's a great point. And like we mentioned, international migration is still a huge part of this as well. You still got lots of folks moving here from Latin America, from parts of Asia. So these are all sort of moving parts that have changed over the years. But like Adam says, there's some major takeaways in how things have shifted just in the last few years.
Okay. So we're getting, a lot of feedback from listeners about this. Blue Ridge Boiler says lots of good reasons to leave. But the easy answer even back in 2007 for me was I could never see raising a family there with the cost of living. Quality of life isn't close to outweighing just the high cost of living and real estate. Where someone else calling themselves Burned Sea Gills. Sorry, guys, if I mispronounce your Twitter handles here, but says, as someone who was lucky to survive childhood in Texas, I can attest that the state is not a great place to live. Yeah, don't leave those golden retrievers in your car during scorching Texas summers. So maybe one vote against the Lone Star State there. But let's turn back to California. Adam and Lauren, we actually talked briefly to a native-born Californian who left the state, and his name is Ben Koo. And for him, the idea for leaving California actually came a few years ago.
I think it was late 2015 or early 2016. I was in this cycle where I was attending a lot of going-away parties for people I know. And that wasn't particularly new, but the frequency was increasing.
Koo is editor-in-chief of the sports and pop culture blog The Comeback. And in his conversations with those folks who left California, he noticed a common thread.
The people I was talking to who are moving to like Salt Lake City and Portland and Austin and Denver, you know, whenever I caught up with them after the move, they were so happy with the move.
Koo says his life in the Bay Area was actually fairly comfortable. He grew up there. He owned a house, which given Bay Area prices, pretty good. But he couldn't help wondering, would he have a better quality of life elsewhere? So he looked to Columbus, Ohio, a city he occasionally visited since graduating from Ohio State in 2006.
Every time I came back, Columbus was growing a little bit hipper and cooler and more diverse. And at the same time, I feel like where I was in the Bay Area, it was getting harder to move around, and places that I liked going to go out to eat or drink were closing down. And, you know, it was kind of trending in the opposite direction.
So in December 2017, Koo made the leap. He moved to Columbus. Result? Leaving the Bay Area only reinforced to him how real its problems were. So we asked Koo what would need to change in order to bring him back to California.
You know what? I don't see California solving the problems. The traffic and the density, the transportation issues, life is just easier when you leave. The thing that I kind of remember the most is often I would go out to do something and I would be at a light. And it would turn green, but the road that you'd be turning on would be so backed up that the cars in the turn lane would have nowhere to turn onto. It was no cars would move during the green light. And that would happen like frequently. And, you know, in the Bay Area, the rush hour became a 3 to 7:30, 8 p.m. thing. It's hard to see California kind of fixing those issues.
That's Ben Koo, formerly a Californian. Now living in Columbus, Ohio, he's editor-in-chief of the sports and pop culture blog, The Comeback. Okay, so Lauren and Adam, Ben Koo there says that these deeply entrenched problems he doesn't see California solving. I don't really, I'm not going to give up hope on any part of this country, but he's getting us right to the question of the policies, the longstanding policies over the past several, many decades in California that have brought the state to this point. So, Adam, let me start with you here. First and foremost, again, in my zeal today to just really bust simplistic narratives, or at least check them, as Lauren noted earlier, we're seeing a lot of headlines that are saying that it's California's progressive governance that has caused this exodus. What do you think about that?
First of all, I'd like to say I am here for all of your zeal. second, I don't know that progressive is the right word. So that wonderful narrative you just played, I think, captures so many things worth unpacking, right? So quality of life, housing, transportation. So from an economic point of view, waiting at a light, commuting 3 hours, none of those are good things for productivity. That is an inefficient use of human capital, right? So that isn't a net winner for any sort of economy, California or otherwise. I think the real thing I think a lot about is, why is the world this way? So as an elder millennial, when we were playing Oregon Trail and I was thinking about California or the West, I wasn't thinking about the regulatory infrastructure we find ourselves in, some sort of Baroque general plan with lots of planning regulations, zoning requirements, density, the size of my front yard, the shadow my roof can cast, those sorts of things. And I think what's interesting is I don't think of them as progressive necessarily. I think of them as maybe generational or some other kind of dimension of the challenge, because we know how to build houses, right? We have the technology, elevators for more dense urban areas. We know how to do lots of things, including transit. But for some reason, the political structure isn't allowing us to do any of those things that basic planners, basic economists have figured out.
Because people don't want to pay for it. I mean, I think ultimately it's what it seems to me. Lauren, I'm going to toss this one to you. California may have a reputation for its state governance recently to be socially liberal, but the state of California has a two generation long track record of not actually being all that economically liberal. I mean, the issues that Ben Koo was talking about that made him leave, I mean, he's talking about a lack of investment, right, in transportation, in housing. So let's rewind the clock and really just use one very powerful example of that, because I think Californians across the political spectrum have shown again and again they don't want to pay. So can we tell the story of Proposition 13 from 1978? What did Prop 13 do?
Yep, that's a really good place to start. So Prop 13 was a constitutional amendment in the state in 1978 that capped property taxes and has since become sort of the sacred cow of California politics. There have been some recent challenges, but nothing has broken through at all. And basically what's happened is that now decades later, you've got people who are sitting on houses that they bought for maybe $100,000, not very much money at the time. And they're continuing to pay extremely low tax rates on that. So that forces those who have bought in after that to pay much higher rates. And in practice, it leads to people kind of hunkering down, staying in their houses for generations, passing it down. You see that a lot in places like where I live, a beach town, Santa Cruz, outside the Bay Area, where you've got multiple generations all being like, okay, this is our one shot at homeownership. We've got to stay here. And since the state doesn't build housing, there's no inventory for the people that do move here and want to buy.
Well, so let's talk about what specifically that 1978 voter approved rule. I mean, I was looking at some voting maps from 1978, and as far as I can tell, only two counties did not vote in favor of Prop 13. But so what it did is it limited tax rates to 1% of the assessed value of a home, and also changed the way that properties are assessed, and then limited to how much annual assessment increases could happen on individual properties to 2% or the rate of inflation. Adam, do I have that right?
Yeah, absolutely. The 1970s were a period, a lot of things were happening, and there was a very real taxpayer revolt. The interesting thing is that it freezes property tax in time. So in a lot of ways, it's a scheme that protects or gives benefit to people who got here first. It preserves kind of an existing lifestyle at the expense of newcomers. And so you can see this. I mean, I think the Twitter memes are very interesting these days around the unequal property taxes levied on folks in similar properties. So if you were to look at these two properties, you wouldn't be able to tell much of a difference. Yet when someone moved in, can radically shape how much they pay in property taxes.
And what would those taxes have gone to fund?
In California, there's kind of a pre Prop 13 California and a post Prop 13 California. I mean, our UC system is really unparalleled in terms of a public higher education system, research and development, healthcare. Just the footprint of that as a public undertaking, just I think shows kind of the optimism of Californians at our peak. Funding has dramatically been curtailed since the passage of Prop 13, not only for higher education, but for a whole host of services. Local governments are often starved for revenue, school districts, and so on and so forth. And so when folks talk about the cost of living, I often think that along with housing, their gut reaction is that there are a lot of pay to play things in everyday life, whether it's the parking ticket under your windshield wiper or your DMV registration or all the little kind of day to day activities you do. We've had to monetize those. Local governments have had to monetize those to make up for lost revenue from property taxes.
So it's shifting then the burden. Is it, let me phrase it as a question. Is it shifting the burden for revenue generation for these essential services that you're talking about, education, et cetera, away from property owners who were there before 1978 towards other sources, income, sales tax, the parking tickets you were talking about?
Right. Absolutely. Sales tax is a really interesting example. When local jurisdictions have to raise sales tax, economists, policymakers, again, know that that's a very regressive way to solve our fiscal woes. A wealthy person pays the same as a really poor person. maybe struggling on the margins of society. I think what's interesting is even when you go back to that debate in the late 70s, we're talking about an asset, so people's home and property, that was going up in value. The taxes were going up because the thing people owned was also becoming more valuable. And so, I laugh about some of the political advertising back in the 70s and 80s around these topics. They show grandmother being moved to the curb. She's being priced out of her home. Well, that's good politics, but grandma's generally her housing has gone up quite a bit during that period of time, and it's an asset she owns.
Well, Adam Fowler and Lauren Hepler, stand by. I'm going to dig in more into how Lauren, actually, in Cal Matters, one of your colleagues talked about Prop 13 having almost mythical powers in terms of its ability to survive and the effect that has had on life in California today. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about collective mental health a year into this pandemic. So we want to know, how has isolation affected you? How have the economic hardships had an impact on you? What about your kids? How are they doing? It's okay to say things are not okay, but we want to hear your stories. Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. We're going to be talking about collective mental health on the show tomorrow. Today, we are taking a look at the state of California. Right now, there is a very potent narrative about the California exodus, how it's become too expensive, too overregulated to live there. So people are leaving the state. And so we're sort of checking that narrative here and trying to dig past the headlines and understand what's really driving the current economic conditions in California. And I'm joined today by Lauren Hepler. She's economy reporter for Cal Matters, joining us from Santa Cruz. Adam Fowler is also with us. From Los Angeles, he's director of research at Beacon Economics and the University of California Riverside Center for Economic Forecasting and Development. Now, so Lauren, I'm not yet done with the story of Prop 13 because I'm absolutely fascinated by it. Because it was first passed in 1978, as we talked about, put a cap on how much tax revenue or how much revenue could come from property taxes. And it's had this incredible staying power all the way up until November of last year, where there was yet another effort to at least change some of the rules around Prop 13, right? There was another proposition, Prop 15, which could have raised some, what, at least $6 billion of revenue for the state?
Yeah, and this was supposed to be a big bellwether. Like, are we finally at a moment where parts of Prop 13 could start to be challenged? Because people have attempted this in the past, and the basic framework of that policy is still there. It still, like, very much dictates what's happening with the housing market. But Prop 15 would have specifically looked at the commercial property side of things and allowed the taxes to be raised on that side. It would not have touched sort of the taxes that folks are paying on the houses they've owned for a long time. But the messaging on that campaign was very interesting because it very much said, oh, they're coming for the commercial properties now, but just wait, they're coming for your residential real estate next. And that certainly resonated with voters I talked to. They said, I'm not touching this. I don't want to change how things are working. So Prop 15 failed. It was very close, but it did fail. So now the question is kind of what will happen next? Is there another campaign that can learn lessons from that and take it on? Or will the staying power of Prop 13 sort of live on?
So I come back to this question then. I mean, if Prop 15 failed, which it did, not if, it did, as you said. I mean, part of the reason why opponents to the proposition, what they were saying was like the worst time to raise taxes on commercial real estate is in the middle of the pandemic. That's also that was an issue as well. But the underlying idea that they could then come for your home property taxes, I just wonder, like, there is this, is this a problem of like California's nightmare progressive governance, or is it just that it's hard to come up with a new revenue mix for the 21st century that people are willing to pay in for?
Yeah, it's a good question. But I think one reason that people have been disinclined to change Prop 13 is because places like some of the suburbs in Silicon Valley have found a creative way to get around some of this. And that's that they can just continue to approve offices and generate taxes off of commercial land, new commercial developments, instead of building more housing. So you look at a place like Palo Alto, where there's only one housing unit for, I think it's like a half dozen jobs, it's like 3 to 6 jobs. I need to check the most recent number. But the idea is that people have been flocking to these places for jobs, specifically in the tech industry, and the local building has not kept up, and that's profitable for the cities. So another big question is, where is the state in all of this? Why aren't they sort of forcing cities to live up to, you know, the amount of housing they're supposed to be building each year? And that's where you can start to see that, yeah, Prop 13 is definitely the foundation upon which a lot of this was built, but there's very much modern policy decisions that are influencing all of this as well.
Oh, that is fascinating. So, Adam Fowler, where is the state in all of this, specifically to the question that Lauren was asking?
That is a really good question. A little too asleep at the wheel for some of our concerns in the economics community. I think you're finally seeing, I think, a younger generation of state legislators begin to take up the mantle of reforming this. I really think there is a kind of a generational aspect. You know, hot takes on blog posts and on podcasts. There's a certain amount of affluence of lived experience in this, the housing crisis impacting folks up the household income and occupational kind of food chain and bringing that more to the forefront. And so there have been the last few years a number of bills in the state legislature to help up zone around transportation. So California has a lot of progressive and forward-looking kind of elements in our brand, one being our focus on climate. And as we move forward to the climate goals we've set in the state, transportation, so forcing people farther and farther from where they work, is a real impact. It's a real driver of our greenhouse gas emissions. And so as we think about how we meet our climate goals, the lack of housing development is really coming into focus. As we've, again, you opened the segment with some of the talk about wildfires, because development has been so hard, we've pushed people to these urban wildfire zones on the edge of our dense urban areas, and it's really become problematic over time.
Well, this is really touching a nerve amongst On Point listeners. Hello, everybody out there who's leaving us comments. Gertrude Larkin says, go, leave. I'm chomping at the bit to get back to California. I regret leaving the state. When people leave, I have more opportunity, beaches, mountains, skiing, hiking. I'm ready to move. Megan says, we moved from the Bay Area of California in July 2019. A big reason was the cost of housing. Someone calling themselves your best friend said, my wife and I moved out of California after our first daughter was born. We were priced out of the housing market and couldn't get our daughter into a good school district. We moved to my home state of Iowa. It's got its problems for sure, but they pale in comparison to the daily struggle in California. And Philip Sebron on Facebook is saying, California is nice, but it's like rich people, and they're the only ones who can afford to live there. The rent's too high. Forest fires, rolling blackouts, water rationing don't help. Did I mention earthquakes? But I don't mind paying higher taxes for good infrastructure, schools, government services, and universal healthcare. Well, we've been focusing on revenue generation a lot, but I want to just also briefly touch on the regulatory environment in California, because certain members of the business community point to that as reasons why they have left. For example, this is David Lemstra, a dairyman who moved from California to South Dakota last year. And he said his main issue was that California, in his view, was over-regulating his farm. And so what did that mean for him practically?
Yeah, I'll tell you a little story or history. We built a brand new dairy in California in 2008. And it took us 7 years and approximately $1 million to permit that dairy. We remodeled the dairy out here. It took us about 10 weeks and $10,000 to permit the dairy in South Dakota.
And Lemstra says his dairy farm is a family business. His decision to move out of California was about his family and finding better opportunities for them. So, Adam Fowler, I mean, we don't actually have time to dig into, you know, the many, I'm sure, millions of pages of regulation that exist in a state as big as California. But how often do you hear this, that it might be harder to do business there than folks in certain sectors would like?
I think it's a little overblown. I think the example you just cited was an important one, and there are a number of examples. Farms, dairies. There's a lot of interesting things we could go into about how water is allocated and kind of the grandfathered in way. A lot of our farming community really has some kind of outsized benefits. But the interesting thing, I think, the note before about I would be willing to pay higher taxes, I actually think that's a bit of a false narrative as well. I think if we rebalanced, I don't think this the things we need in the state actually are going to require paying higher taxes. I think it takes a rebalancing. We lean on income taxes in California. We lean on sales taxes to make up for these other revenue streams, especially property tax. And people do pay a lot in income tax and sales tax to make up. But if there's a rebalancing, I think folks, the average person who is not a homeowner, we're now a majority renter state, would really potentially pay less if it was structured right.
And yet Proposition 15 in November of just last year did not pass. I mean, wouldn't that have have achieved a little bit or the beginnings of that rebalancing?
Absolutely. And so, you know, I go back to the kind of system is built. The status quo is the status quo for a reason. It's not by accident. There are interests aligned in various ways. And it was a tough campaign. It was very close at the end of the day, a lot closer than I thought. I think because there's such a generational component to this in California, and I think that the narrative is changing. Maybe it was a third rail 20, 30 years ago, but I think there's a real conversation starting to happen about reforming the fiscal landscape in California.
Okay, so the narrative is changing, even as we're trying to bust other narratives, trying to break them down here. But in the last few minutes that we have, I mean, Lauren, what I glean from this conversation is that beyond the sort of California exodus fiery YouTube videos, really what we have here is an issue that, as with everything in California, it's like really in sharp relief because California is so big, right? But there are issues that should be resonating in other parts of the country too. I mean, we have a decades-long lack of investment or underinvestment, which in part is driven by rising inequality. You're talking about how businesses and the wealthy are actually benefiting from certain structures right now in California, and you know, systems of revenue that have essentially a revenue generation that have been kind of preserved in aspic for 40 years. So it sounds like even in this, you know, supposedly most modern of states, what California needs is a modernization of its policy making to meet the needs of California in 2021.
Yeah, and I mean, you certainly see that in areas like people's daily commutes. Granted, it's changed a bit during the pandemic, but that traffic is already coming back, I can tell you, if you're going up to an Oakland or a San Francisco. But one of the things you see there is just how broken the transportation infrastructure is, because the Bay Area has 27 different transit agencies. So a lot of this is sort of like having modern systems that communicate with one another, that can build on one another, instead of each operating in their own little chaotic universe. And I think that you also see California, they attempted to get ahead of the curve on something like gig work they had a measure called AB5 that said, okay, we're going to take Uber drivers, these other independent contractors, and we're going to make them employees as part of this effort. They said, the left-leaning Democrats who backed the measure said, to sort of bring our workforce into the 21st century and to get at some of that inequality you mentioned. But then we saw voters this November roll that back. And again, I think the pandemic very much came into the messaging from companies like Uber and Lyft saying, this is not the time to be getting experimental in our policy. And ultimately, now those workers have reverted back to independent contractors with much less worker protection. So smaller subsidies for healthcare, that kind of thing. So these are all ongoing conversations, and the pandemic has influenced them in a really interesting way.
Okay. So Adam, we're seeking solutions here. Where would you focus if you were to be given a magic wand to sort of start this modernization process? What would you do?
Yeah, I think it's going to have to come from the state legislature in terms of I think one of the first things is to legalize really multifamily and dense housing. In California, affordable housing is often multifamily housing, condos, apartments, things like that. We need to fast track that development around a lot of our transit investments in California. We need to take the pressure off of the existing stock. I think it's as much a moral issue as it is an economics issue. We've kind of rolled up the carpet behind the folks that got here first. I am always reminded of the economist David Ricardo, who was chewing on these issues way back, and he thought about, we don't want to build an economy or a society where the good farmland is grabbed by the first generation and everyone else is constantly reduced to rockier, more less productive land. We don't want to build a system where you kind of come in the world or what time you plant your flag. The entire system gives the opportunity only to those folks. And so I think there's great opportunity. I'm optimistic. I moved from Texas to California to go to graduate school. Why? Because the investment in the UC system, right? So talent is here. The interest is here. I'm still here. I'm as frustrated as anyone, but business will be where talent is. And California is one of the top locations for talent. The final thing I would say is, I love your point about this is a U.S. problem. For as much as the political dialogue is kind of California is its own thing, the California economy and its function or non-function is a huge part of the U.S. economy. And so the U.S. economy sinks or swims with California. And so we all have a vested interest in making sure we do it right here in the state, even if you're not in California.
Texas isn't calling you back?
No, it's too humid.
Adam Fowler, Director of Research at Beacon Economics and the University of California Riverside Center for Economic Forecasting and Development, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Lauren Hepler, economy reporter for Cal Matters, with us from Santa Cruz. Lauren, thank you so much, and go banana slugs.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.